Come on in. Come on in, Z-Pack. This is Winnie. Oh, she's a whippet, right?
She's a whippet.
Winnie the
whippet. Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill.
The most beautiful.
You are so cute.
You saved Europe.
You
did.
Saved Europe. Saved Europe.
Saved the world.
Saved my heart. Pete Poulos, because she's so beautiful. Guys, welcome. It's your boy Z-Dog MD, and this is Dr. Peter Poulos, Pete to his homies. He is clinical associate professor of radiology at Stanford. Been on the show before.
Yes.
Thank you.
Whoa,
darling.
Right, bye, Winnie.
Darling.
It was really nice having you.
We're going to go bye-bye.
Yes.
Oh,
okay.
You are so sweet. This is a whippet. They are like faster than the wind.
That was better in theory than in
practice than in practice, but in practice also pretty awesome.
Oh, my God.
Saudi, welcome back to the show, brother.
Thanks, Zubin.
Man, so y'all remember Pete, Dr. Poulos, from the last show we did 2 years ago now in this very backyard where we talked about his being a gastroenterology fellow at UCSF, having a freak accident on a bicycle in San Francisco, resulting in a crazy story, which I'll link to in the show notes for this later, that left him a C3-4 quadriplegic. His long recovery and the struggles that he's had and the successes that he's had that were really inspiring. When we did the video, so many people like messaged me. They were like, dude, can you hook me up with Pete? Because I also struggle with disabilities, or I have chronic illness, or I have a lot of things going on that I think he would have insight on. And since that show, you have undertaken a new sort of project that I think is going to help a lot of people with disabilities. Fill me in on all this, Pete. Welcome back to the show, brother.
A lot's going on, a lot new here. So I helped start a group called the Stanford Medicine Abilities Coalition, SMAC for short.
SMAC!
SMACDOWN! Came out of the Faculty Senate Subcommittee on Diversity, interestingly enough, out of the realization that disability isn't well represented in the overall diversity movement. And so Iris Gibbs was our subcommittee chair, and Phil Harder.
I know Phil, ER doc.
Great. We had our first meeting and we were pitching ideas for a project for the year. And I said, how about disability? And they loved it and started a group called SMAC, like I said. And we are growing quickly right now.
And Laura King already says, look, I'm a tube-fed gastroparesis sufferer. Fantastic episode. So there is something about having chronic illness, having some form of disability that has not historically meshed with healthcare practice. And whether it's access issues, whether it's discrimination, whether it's just having the tools and the resources to succeed when you have particular needs that, say, somebody who's fully able to do this stuff may not necessarily have, although maybe even could benefit from. What have the struggles been for you, and how did it kind of prompt you to start this organization?
Well, you know, I've been at Stanford now on the faculty for 10 years.
Nerd.
Yes, nerd is right. And I mean, you know, I'm just now getting around to the point where I feel like I have the bandwidth to, like, be able to reach out in a meaningful way to other people en masse. I mean, it's been, like you said, a struggle. Right, there was having to do another residency again, there was a second fellowship, there's been like just the struggle of the day-to-day being on the faculty, helping out as an associate program director with the residency, and now I'm getting to a place where I feel like I'm ready to build something and to help others.
You know, and let me fill in some of those blanks for people who don't remember the last show or didn't see the last show. So Pete was a GI fellow, had done an internal medicine residency, was a GI fellow at UCSF when he had his accident, and realized that probably the best fit moving forward for what was a good training option for him was radiology. Rematches in radiology, does a whole second radiology fellowship and a body imaging fellowship. So radiology residency, body imaging fellowship. And they're like, you know, he's done more than most of us who haven't had a significant disability have been able to do. And so now you're saying you're able to start to catch up and saying Maslow's hierarchy, we were talking about this earlier, is starting to be fulfilled. Like, okay, safety, security, food, connection. Now wine. It's like wine, yeah. Which, by the way, I'm drinking. Just me. Let's see my teeth. They're kind of purple. And we had a barbecue, and we're like, we got to do this show because people need to know about what he's doing. So now you're at this sort of, how do you find purpose and meaning in the adversity that you face and help other people to succeed, because you've had the path. You've actually shown that it's doable. I mean, Pete, look, guys, like, I won't say this to his face because, you know, that would be weird.
Looking away.
Look away. This dude's an inspiration, you guys. Like, like, I could not have done.
The I word.
The I word. I'm going to use the I word about Pete. And so we're hoping now with the work he's doing, we can bring a little coalition of people together that can help people with significant disabilities, chronic disease, actually succeed in healthcare. Because you know what? We probably need you more than the average person, because you have a perspective on adversity and injury and struggling with health issues and interfacing with the healthcare system as a patient that other people don't have.
We all do. And there are so many people out there in the medical field who could contribute so much to society and work so much more effectively if they were just given the chance. Mm. I mean, who better to understand our patients than people who have had to deal with a disability or a chronic illness, right? It's really like I'm not talking about just making accommodations for people who are disabled who happen to be in the medical field. I'm talking about a total change of mindset into like actively seeking out people with disabilities and chronic illness who know better than anyone else how to treat our patients and how to care for them. Not just disabled patients, but underrepresented patients of every kind.
Well, so, okay, I'll play devil's advocate. I'll play the resident who has to now cover an extra shift because of the accommodations required, because there's more easily fatigued, or there's other accommodations that need to happen in order to have somebody with a significant disability performing medicine. And it used to be in the old days, you just didn't even do it. Someone who is hard of hearing or hearing disabled, you know, you can't be a doctor because you can't use a stethoscope. And now we have hospitalists who are profoundly deaf and are able to do it. We have people like yourself who are C3-4 quadriplegics who are able to practice medicine, radiology at the highest academic levels, at the most elite facilities and organizations in the country. But how do you respond to people who say, well, this is just going to be more work for the quote-unquote able body?
Yeah, it might be. It might be more work for the able-bodied. But in the end, it's better. It's better for the institution, and it's better for our patients. Mm. Mm. It's just better. I mean, people with disabilities bring something to the table that those who haven't dealt with hardship or disability or struggle that they may not understand quite as well. Mm. And, you know, I dealt with this in my own residency, right? So I couldn't take night float. Granted, I will say that I was an extra resident in my class.
Right, so they added you on.
They added me on because somebody quit out of the third year class and they wanted to add on at first year instead of taking a transfer. So I was an extra resident, but, you know, the people in my class respected the fact that I did take call every week. I worked every Wednesday, 5 to 10 p.m. They would do, you know, weeks at a time of night float from 6 p.m. to 8 a.m. But on their Pete nights, as they used to call them on Wednesdays, I would work their early shift and they would hang out in the call room and then not come to work basically until it was 10 o'clock. Mm. And, you know, I think that We need to combat stigma. We need to combat the stigma that comes with being disabled, because like it or not, people in medicine have been more ableist in the past, have looked at disability through a negative lens, and that bleeds over and translates into our interactions with patients. Mm. And I remember what it was like before I got hurt. I just didn't get it. And I'm not saying, I may have been like, you know, needed a little remediation myself in this fact, maybe not everybody, but I certainly feel now that I have maybe more to offer my patients than I did before. Although now I'm in radiology, so it doesn't matter quite as much. But.
You know, my wife will argue, well, no, you actually affect patient care more than a lot of people. I think, see, some stuff he said there that was interesting to me is this idea that I think many of us actually are a little bit ableist. I've actually been accused of it in statements, in unconscious statements that I've said even on the show. People say, you know, what you just said is very ableist. You're saying, you know, this, and you're kind of normalizing. You're subtly saying that people with disabilities are actually not able to deliver this amazing care. And it actually takes people to be woken up, because obviously society in at baseline kind of normalizes whatever normal ability is. And so someone like yourself, who has to be accommodated on some level but actually excels on other levels, like, first of all, understanding what it's like, I imagine you do body CT, body radiology. Like, you have a perspective on injury and trauma, and also being present, and also having a second chance to do what you're passionate about that other people don't have, that would bring a real power to it. And I think when we, the other downside, I think, with marginalizing people with disabilities is you're taking a huge talent pool out of the equation.
Yeah.
And these are people that are really good at what they do, and you're saying, no, you can't do it because X, Y, and Z. And I think the other thing you said that I thought was interesting is, like, yeah, sometimes you do have to accommodate, and there will have to be some sacrifice on other people's part. And that's actually, not only is it okay, it's actually part of what we do as healthcare providers, to actually provide the best care for our patients. I mean, we take call, we do these things.
We make these calculations all the time.
All day.
What's better for society, what's better for our population, right?
Absolutely. So why can't we do the same thing? Now, the question is, you started this organization and it's really snowballed, but obviously you saw a need, right? So there were obstructions to people with disabilities getting training, getting the ability to care for people in the hospital. What did you see with that?
Well, you know, I will say, first of all, that, you know, I have a lot of gratitude for the people that have made my life easier along the way. I would say that, you know, Stanford has been great to me. I've gotten a lot of support from Brooke Jeffrey, my division chief, and Sam Gambier, my chairman, and all of my colleagues. I have support from the hospital volunteer office.
Oh.
I have personal assistants who help me throughout the day. It takes a lot, okay, for me to be able to get to do what I do. And it works so well that maybe that was also part of the reason that I didn't get into this
earlier.
But, I mean, it started with myself. I mean, I went on interviews for radiology, and there were program directors who told me, I just don't see how this is going to work. You know, like, I see my residents, they're moving around, they're hanging films, they're so busy, and I can't picture you doing that. You know, I just think it's going to be too hard for you. And Stanford took a different approach, thankfully. They were able to see past the disability. They said, look, you have this prior training in internal medicine and some training in GI. This disability brings a different perspective to things, and we will make it work. Mm. We'll figure it out, you know? And where some people just saw a liability, Stanford saw a possibility. Mm. And along the way, I've met people who just keep hitting brick walls where there should be doors. Like, I can answer your question in more detail if you like about some people that I've met along the way.
Yeah, because these people have been messaging me since our last show, and including some comments right now. What about mental health? What about chronic disease like fibromyalgia, other things like that? Yeah, so tell me some stories.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to say, well, first of all, SMAC is not about just motor and sensory disabilities. It's also about psychological, learning, chronic illness, basically anything that makes it difficult to do our jobs. We're taking a very expansive definition of the role of disability. This isn't just folks in wheelchairs. And there are a lot of invisible disabilities out there. We have a lot of members in our organization who, looking at them, you wouldn't know of the struggles that they go through. You know, these and that is tough, right? That it's a lot easier for me to come with a wheelchair and crutches and ask for an accommodation than for somebody who looks normal, looks healthy, and they're young, and they're saying, I can't do this or that, I need help with this or that, and it's met with a lot of skepticism, you know?
Even you, because people are talking about, tell Pete about the Segway. It's like, Pete knows about the Segway. Pete's been using the Segway. And he's been actually, one of the great stories you told last time was about how people will come up to him and be like, you're a douchebag for rolling around the hospital in that Segway, because he doesn't look like a C3-4 quadriplegic. And people think he's just rolling around on the thing, right?
I've met people all over the country, like, well, this is a big thing that's going on right now with service animals right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right, and the controversy. But, you know, some veterans and other people with PTSD have service dogs that help them with their anxiety and with their psychological disabilities. And I hear a story about these people being, like, confronted. Like, you don't look blind. Why do you have a dog?
Mm-hmm,
you know, very insensitive things like that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's funny. We did a Doc Vader about this where he was complaining about service animals that are not for those purposes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have the VA or the veterans and so on. And then you have, like, Buffy who just wants to bring her dog on the plane.
Yeah, well,
and yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, there's always going to be abuse, I think, of a system that's meant to help people.
Mm.
And just because there are some cases of abuse doesn't mean that you throw out the whole accommodation for people who need them.
Mm.
That doesn't bother me if, like, one person wants to bring her dog into a restaurant and she doesn't have a certificate, or maybe it's just her pet and not her comfort dog.
Mm.
If there's a whole lot of other people out there who need the dog who get to have access.
Lisa Hollenbeck says, how about we assume the best about people?
Exactly. Yeah. Assume the best. Mm-hmm. That's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, there was a person that I talked to a few years ago who had some autonomic issues. Okay, invisible on it. It was dizziness. It was low blood pressure, orthostatic hypotension.
Like a POTS type of syndrome, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. Ended up being very difficult to diagnose. Kept him out of school for over a year. But when he was finally diagnosed, put on a medication regimen, and feeling back strong enough to go back to school, they wouldn't let him back.
What? Why?
They wanted, he put together a packet, you know, here's why, here's the sign off from my doctor that I'm ready to go back, and with this particular regimen, you know, I'm cleared for service. But they wanted more proof, they wanted more recent proof, they wanted me to undergo more testing, and after a while it just became clear to him that they didn't want him back.
Mm.
Because he was asking for things.
Mm.
He was asking on his surgical rotations if they were rounding for a long time, if he could, like, sit down when they were stopped talking about a patient outside the room.
Mm.
Or if he were like standing in there for surgery with retractors for, I don't know, an hour or 2 hours, that there might be a maximum amount of time that he would do that and somebody else would come and relieve him because of his fatigue.
Mm.
And these things were just unacceptable. And so he reached out to me about this, and we strategized about ways to get him back in the clinic. But this is just one of many stories I've heard about people being treated unfairly because of their disability or chronic illness.
And, you know, it's so tough because that's a horrible story, and yet then you hear about, like, you know, these Laughlin women and these guys who are cheating getting their kids into college by saying they had learning disabilities and needed extra time on the test and so on. So people are primed to disbelieve people who look like they're okay and then claim a disability. And so how do you think we overcome that? Do you just assume the best about people? Do you take that collateral damage? What's SMAC's approach? And by the way, there's a link in the description of this video to the Facebook site where you have your thing, and we'll put an Instagram and the other links as well. So if you have a disability, you're struggling with a chronic illness, you can definitely go to those Facebook pages. We really want to grow this coalition to create a good body of support for this.
Medical students, and I think most people in general, don't want to stick out from the bunch. I mean, nobody wants to go to their dean of students. Okay, maybe there's some abuse, fine, whatever. But most people do not want to go to their dean of students, single themselves out as having a learning disability, to ask for more time on a test if they don't really need it.
Mm.
Nobody wants their classmates to think that they're weak, you know, so to speak. Everyone in medicine wants to play strong and independent and I mean, you know the game, right? So I just don't think that there are many people out there who are asking for accommodations that they don't need.
Mm-hmm. I think that game, that same culture that you're talking about, where people want to look strong and there's a suck it up thing, is part of maybe the problem where, you know, you've had a bunch of surgeons on rounds and they're like, wait, this guy needs what? He can't hold a retractor for 8 hours? Why? Oh, because he has, you know, postural, you know, orthostatic hypotension or autonomic problems. Like, I don't see it. Like, suck it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a piece of it.
Right? Yeah, I mean, there are, like, cultural problems that are wrong with medicine, you know? And I owe a lot of my insight into this to Lisa Meeks from Michigan and Nira Jain from the University of Auckland, who have been, like, my mentors and teachers in this regard. Mm. They published a great report from the AAMC about diversity and inclusion in medical education. They have a coalition called the Coalition for Disability Access in Health Science Education. Mm. And I actually met them this past April in Washington, D.C. Their next conference is going to be in Santa Rosa in April, just like as a plug. But, you know, they identify barriers as structural barriers and cultural barriers. Okay, and the cultural barriers to being accepted in medicine are very complicated, right? Because they're not just in medicine, they're in society, they're in everything. And it's about like breaking down that cultural framework and rebuilding it, right? And this benefits everybody, not just people with disabilities, right? This is about wellness. This is about diversity, about openness, about just being able to ask for help. And it's something that's been sorely lacking in medicine for a long time. But so, for example, for our group, talking about cultural things, we want to, you know, evaluate not just our physical space for accessibility, but also, you know, our policies and procedures, the way that we are approaching this issue. We want to educate people about their colleagues with disabilities and about students with disabilities so they really understand like that this is a real issue. Mm. And we need to promote disability as a part of diversity, because it is. It's a huge part of diversity. You know, about 20% by some accountings of the US population has some form of disability. It's very underrepresented in medicine. 2.7%, maybe
really?
4.5%, really? According to more recent studies.
That doesn't surprise me, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the assumption is there that you need to be superhuman just to get through it, and right. That any kind of disability would be a hindrance. Even when I was training, it was like, well, you can't be hard of hearing.
Yeah, well, this is like, it's laid out in a lot of the policies and procedures, or what we call technical standards in medical schools.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of this is like codified, you know, and I don't know the exact words, but you know, you have to be able to save somebody's life, basically, or do CPR, provide life-saving activity, provide life-saving treatment, etc., which is great if you can, but not totally necessary, and certainly out of step with the possibilities of 21st century medicine.
Right.
And we want to propose, well, not only at Stanford, but at other places, we take a look at these technical standards and say, you know, how can we open these up to everyone? Because there are a lot of fields that where people don't need to be Superman to practice.
And, you know, people, even healthcare providers, should be able to ask for help. Leilani Baca. So Pete is actually remarkable, because he has had good practice saying, you know what, can you give me that? Can you bring that closer to me? Can you go ahead and slide that over here? And the people who work with him and who know him and who are friends with him, this is just a natural way of being in the world, right? But for so many, it's such a strange stigma, right? You're new and you're like, how do I ask for help? And in healthcare, it's all about the suck it up culture and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing is, it's not like you were, so even before all this started, you're a super gunner, dude. Like, I mean, UCSF, yeah. GI Fellowship.
Closet Gunner.
Closet Gunner. Oh, no, yeah,
closet
right.
Gunner.
No, right. Because
I got the Closet Gunner Award for my class in medical school.
Dude, you get congrats from me.
Thank you.
People accused me, too, of being a closet gunner. To this day, I'm in denial about it. I'm like, no, that can't be. I was a total slacker. I sat in the back. But apparently there was something there.
It's an entity.
It is an entity.
Yeah, the closet gunner.
So for those who don't know, a gunner, it's a kind of a UCSF West Coast slang, isn't it? I don't know that they use it as much on the East Coast.
Oh, we said it in Texas. Well,
did you?
Yeah, but I don't know about that East Coast.
Yeah.
You'd have to ask Margaret.
But she trained at Stanford, and gunner was a thing, too. And so a gunner is someone who's like just hardcore, like studies, crushes the competition, single-minded in their pursuit of whatever super specialty they want, right? And a closet gunner is someone who pretends they don't care, that they're chill, but on the back end they're like at home with a microscope, like busting their ass and secretly, you know, competing. And so both Pete and I were accused of being closet gunners. You actually won the award. That's to be commendable.
Yeah,
that's
thank you.
Congratulations.
Class of 99.
Hell yeah, me too. to be the closet gunner and then have to shift into, okay, now I need to ask for help. I need accommodations.
Yeah.
But you're not going to give up. You're going to actually not only do what it is you do, but do it at the highest level, not only in the country, but we're in America. And so the academic facilities here, they're some of the best in the world. So he's a shining example of what you can do. And his injury is not mild, you guys. This is a severe, we talked about it in the last show. I'll link to it. So if Pete can do it, I think it's inspiring for others, and this SMAC organization is going to help kind of set the groundwork for, again, helping to provide accommodation so we can have this diversity that helps all of us, not only colleagues, but also patients, right?
It's been shown, like, not necessarily with disability per se, and I'm not like an expert on all the disability research. I'll just share that right up front. But, you know, when patients are taken care of by people who look like them or they can identify with, there tend to be better outcomes. When their doctors understand their patients, there tend to be better outcomes. So this has been studied and it's been shown to be important, right? I mean, if we're to ever reach out and take care of everyone, this is something that we need to deal with.
And you know, so the comments, I mean, there's so many good comments, dude. Like Sam Neary says, thank you. I'm an ED nurse with multiple sclerosis. I love my vocation. I'm currently asymptomatic, but I won't always be this way. I just love being with patients and students of our craft. I can do this.
Yeah.
What would you say to Sam?
I say you can do this. And, you know, well, depending on her course of MS, it may be that for periods in her life, maybe weeks, maybe months, she may not be able to do her job exactly like she does it now. But hopefully, you know, her work environment could alter the nature of her work as time goes on. And maybe when she's having flares or not doing as well, they could assign her lighter duty or
more administrative
or more teaching. And when she's feeling better or back to it, they can give her an opportunity to do what she wants. But that, to have people with disabilities in your department is a benefit to those people without disabilities, because that having peers who have disabilities improves the people around them. Like, you knowing me improves you. I mean, I know you knew that.
I knew this already. Actually, you know, all joking aside, it does. I'm a better person for knowing Pete because I have better understanding. And he's taught me a lot about stuff. And I'm supposed to know this stuff technically as a doctor? But he'll say things.
We don't get taught it.
No, we don't get taught stuff.
I didn't know anything.
Exactly. Like he.
In fact, if there was anything, I was taught negative things.
Right.
Either overtly or not overtly. I mean, my biggest fear growing up, after I was injured, that I would end up like this particular patient that I took care of in San Francisco, who was all alone, you know, begging for pain meds, staying for a year in the hospital because they couldn't find placement for him. At an appropriate facility.
That's your model. That's in your mind. That's your mental model of what a disability is.
That,
right.
Yeah.
We've all taken
and
care
I'm
of
still, it. And I'm still insecure. You asked like how it's different now. It's not different now. It's still hard. It's still hard to ask for help. And I've I'm established. You know, I've been on my job for 10 years. Imagine how it is for a medical student or a resident to go to their dean of students or their program director and be like, I need help. And, you know, it's so intimidating. And we need to make it easy for them, right? So, like, how do we make it better for students and residents, right? What sort of, like, structural things can we do to make it better for them?
And this is what you're doing now. That's what I think is so great.
Well, it's part of what we're building right now. But, you know, we want disability service providers at Stanford who, like, are very familiar with accommodations, who are familiar with medical education, and who know what to do if a given student or resident or even faculty member needs help. These, what to do or where to go to ask for accommodation should be common knowledge, should be well posted, well advertised, so people know if something is the matter, here's who I go to, I have a point person, right? Mm. And we need to work on making everything accessible for people, like create accessible environments for those people who need it now, but also an accessible, an atmosphere of acceptance so that if people become injured or sick, that they're not afraid to ask for help. And this all feeds into, like, a lot of people are talking about wellness these days, right? It's all about wellness. Well, this is, like, central to wellness, right? Just the ability to, or the comfort in asking for help. That's what it boils down to, right? You're talking about burnout. I know you talk about these issues in your show. You know, you're talking about burnout, or you're talking about having an ulcerative colitis flare or MS or whatever. It's got to be okay to ask for help.
You know, I the only thing I would add to that from my limited understanding of this stuff, and it's limited, and I've learned a lot from you, is all the data seems to suggest that in when one becomes disabled or has an injury or something happens, initially happiness and life satisfaction goes down precipitously, and then very rapidly it rises back to baseline levels. Now people are like, well, how you went from walking and riding your bike and doing all this to, you know, having to use a Segway and asking for help and drinking wine with a straw and different things like that, that are accommodations that you have to make to
good wine with a straw, but not just any wine.
I'm going to show them this wine because they just need
to. We're doing a plug here.
This is an amazing wine that we had. It's a Turnbull. And again, what it shows is that life comes back with a vengeance. You know, you're married. You have an amazing career. You still struggle, but you do it in a way that provides meaning. And we ought to be celebrating that. We ought to be encouraging that. We ought to be keeping that as part of the diversity of the human experience, especially in healthcare, where we affect people when they are at their most vulnerable. And if we're if we're affected by stigma, we pass it on to our patients. And here's a comment, Kristen Haber. I'm an ER physician with post-concussive issues and PTSD. And as a patient, I've been horrified by the treatment I've received by other MDs, as if I'm making everything up.
Yeah, I can empathize. That's rough.
It's rough. And,
yeah,
and that's
an invisible disability, right? People just don't know what to do with that.
And many people have mentioned mental illness as a disability. And I think we have to include that 100%.
Well, there's overlap, right? This is like, people with chronic illness or disability are not one thing. They can also be minorities, underrepresented. They could be LGBT. They could be first generation. They could have like any type of other issues. And everyone has issues.
And Nancy
Why can't we just take people at their word?
Oh, heaven forbid. And Nancy Cardoza has one potential reason. It's so much more of a business than anything now. We can be replaced and we know it, so we suck it up. Is that a piece of it? I'll keep scrolling through comments while we think about that one. Because that's...
I don't know. I don't think that any one of us are particularly easy to replace today. I mean, everybody is special and brings something to the conversation. I don't think anybody is easily replaced. Look, you know, there are complicating issues, right? It's not like everybody with a disability is also like a great employee.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
because you have a disability doesn't mean you're
magically
an angel,
immune from right. You being know? An asshole. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like I can definitely be an a-hole when I want to.
Good for you.
You know, exactly. Yeah. So there's no angelic presence that's bestowed upon you.
Well, being an a-hole was a pre-existing condition for
that's
you.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. So we want to raise awareness, like, you know, disability is a part of diversity. And if a university is going to focus on diversity, they need to include disability in that, right? And we want to fight for accessibility for everyone. And this is the kicker, right? It's not about meeting the standard of the ADA, which is sort of like the lowest the lowest common denominator, right?
Is it? Huh?
Like the letter of the law. We want to go above and beyond that required by law. We want to be proactive about this rather than reactive. We don't want to say, oh, this is something that we have to deal with. How are we going to deal with it? We want to say, like, let's go out there and find people who are special or different and who have something to add, and let's find them. You know?
Man, that it's pretty...
It's a total mindset switch.
It's a mindset switch, yeah. And it's absolutely true, because I think without you, Stanford would be the lesser for it. I mean, my wife's a radiologist at Stanford, and you and her are friends, and her life would be quite a bit less enriched without having you as a colleague. And you almost wouldn't have been there if you didn't have... the help, if you also didn't have your own personality, which is to go and make it happen, even push through all the insecurity and the struggle of it, right? Because it's hard, man. What you've done, like, I don't know that I could do it. I don't have the fortitude. Yeah, I would have to go through that process to test whether I have the fortitude to do it. So, you know, I mean, it's really tough. Let me see here. I was inspired to see intern with a foot drop doing wards jobs on call, Hassan Moose.
Yeah, you know, Sherry Blowett, who's a PM&R physician at Harvard, wrote a great article in the New York Times about being a physician and a patient, you know, and talking about the different reactions that people have. I didn't know if that person was a physician or a patient.
Oh, or both. Don't know, but, yeah. Oh, that's a doc, I think, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I think that people have varying responses when they see me. I do talk to patients occasionally, you know, and there are different reactions when I walk in with my crutch and give them my awkward handshake. But for the most part, when I sit down and I look at them in the eye, there is like a connection there that wasn't there before. It's like an understanding. I think most patients appreciate it, that their doctor has a vulnerability or some sort of soft spot that they can identify that it isn't. And there's nothing wrong with being like able-bodied and healthy and great, you know, but it's just a bit of a different experience. Some people are put off and like, whoa, you're my doctor? Like, what's that about?
Mm-hmm.
But most people, I think, are in some way comforted or inspired or relieved by that sort of interaction. Sherry summed it up really well in her article.
Wow. You know, and I don't know why this popped in my head thinking about this, but do you remember the character Timmy on South Park?
Yeah.
Yeah, so what is Timmy? For those who don't remember, he was a disabled character on South Park. And it's weird because half the time I watched him, I thought, you know, they're really actually going a long way to making Timmy a human being that you really can connect with because of his how special he is. And then half the time it's like, oh my God, what? I mean, what was your take on Timmy overall? It's a strange question, I know, but it's popped
question.
In my
I'm
head.
I'm not a South Park expert.
Right, but you play one on TV.
Right? Yeah, my first instinct was to laugh at Timmy. People used to make fun of me because Timmy also has forearm crutches, and
right.
as do I.
Right.
I don't have the speech problems that
right.
Timmy has.
Right.
But I feel like just having somebody in that show that was not like a complete butt of everybody's jokes, but part of the conversation was good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was my feeling, that at least there's somebody there. And this is like taking, this is gaining traction in Hollywood and other places, like the idea of incorporating disabled people and disabled actors into television shows, integrating them into certain families and normalizing them. I think people are realizing that that's important.
So I think the culture is starting to shift. I think that
so.
was an early iteration of that, believe it or not. South Park has always pushed the boundary of that. You know, and it's funny, some people get very offended, but actually I find that to be a weird kind of progress on many issues. They've talked about a lot of different things. Let's see. Remember his rideshare business episode? I didn't see that one, Rachel. I'm not a South Park expert like Dr. Poulos is also not. Janet Valerie says, yes, it's so important to be humanized as doctors. Relatability is more important now than ever. Now, you told a story in the last show where you'd come back after all this rehab and had, I think, was it in a wheelchair or in a scooter back to the hospital? And one of your attendings saw you and burst into tears when they saw you. And, you know, that's the exact, you have to respect that was their reaction.
Right? Yeah.
But it's kind of like, wow, like, we have a long way to go before people understand what this is, you know? And
but I understand.
You understood it, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But just the contrast, because I was such a physical presence before, and to see me in the wheelchair, I think, was just a startling juxtaposition for him.
So that reaction for you was actually felt correct and natural for that person?
Yeah, you know, so part of, like, I'm not that involved in disability organizations before now. I wasn't. There's a certain part of disability that still makes me sad, right? Sometimes I'm sad for myself. Like, it's not like I'm beyond, like, crying about my injury. It, like, effing sucks, right? There's a lot of things that I want to do that I can't do, and that hasn't gone away, right? And it's not, and so sometimes when I see, and maybe this isn't the right reaction, sometimes I see people in wheelchairs or struggling or with other disabilities, and it makes me sad. And, you know, I've had to step out of meetings sometimes because I've been overcome with emotion at the sadness that I perceive in a situation. A life just isn't fair. Like, I wish that people didn't have to suffer in these ways. So I don't know. I mean, for me, it's just like sometimes I feel sorry for myself. Sometimes I feel sorry for other people. Those are natural emotions, but they don't navigate what we do at an institutional level, an organizational level, you know? And I don't think it changes, like, our humanity, because we all know that, you know, there was an article recently about, like, what is being young, right? Like, a lightness of being, an ease of being, just an easiness. Right? And like, when people don't have that, when they miss out on that, it is sad. You know, it's sad that we have to age and get old and die. It's sad that some people are injured when they're 30 years old because of a stupid bike accident, or that somebody got ran over by a tractor when they were a baby, or that somebody got some shitty autoimmune disease. You know, it's just, I don't know how you get around the sad factor of it.
I mean, we're human beings.
We're human
beings. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, what would the Buddha say? He would say, it's impermanence and we shouldn't cling to these things, but we do because we're humans. And everything's impermanent. What you have now is gone tomorrow. Nothing lasts. Nothing is permanent. And I think the infusion of sadness is a natural counterpoint to also the joy. Like, right before we did the show, you were talking about your trip to France and seeing the World Cup and going up into the Alps. And I was like, damn, homie, you're a baller. Like, I want to do those things. Like, a single...
I don't have children.
Well, lucky. But still, I mean, I think, again, it coexists the sadness in all of us. I mean, we all have our things where we're like, if I had just this and this and this, and with some it's just more acute. So I think we're talking about a universal human condition, which brings us back to why are we not embracing diversity of ability in healthcare and providing support for it?
Yeah. I mean, when I'm in the Alps, you know, I'm complaining to Diana because there's all these guys like climbing the mountain with their ice picks and crampons. And we're taking the elevator up, you know? It's like...
I would choose the elevator myself, but, you know, I'm a little, I'm extreme disabled. So in other words, I just can't do anything extreme. I'm too lazy.
I mean, this has been, it's been a great experience. We have tons of, like, help. We have enthusiastic people who are working on behalf of this team. We were just for the medical school, and now Mary Stutz, who's the chief officer, Stanford has a new chief officer of inclusion, diversity, and health equity from the hospital, who started all of these employee resource groups for different groups of people. There's like Latinx and there's LGBTQ. We have a disabled one, and she's actually asked SMAC to serve as the umbrella organization for the hospital also.
Oh, nice.
So now the Stanford Medicine Abilities Coalition is covering all of Stanford medicine, including the hospital, which goes like from Emeryville to San Jose and Livermore to Palo Alto.
It's, you know, a lot.
We welcome anyone at those sites, you know, off campus to join us also. You know, so we're expanding, and we feel like we're gaining a lot of momentum, but there's like so much to accomplish still. You know, we're hoping to collaborate with other groups too outside of Stanford. So Corey Poffenberger, who's one of our ER attendings, her husband works at Facebook.
Oh.
And he's part of the Abilities employee resource group there. I hope that's okay that I said that, Corey. So we're hoping to hook up with them. I don't know if Google or other of the tech companies in Silicon Valley have any employee resource groups devoted to abilities, but we'd love to meet with them. Or if anybody, it doesn't have to be tech companies, it could be anybody who wants to reach out to us.
I think, yes, it does. It takes a diversity of interdisciplinary stuff. There's one of the comments was like, hey man, mechanical engineers have done more for people with disabilities than doctors ever have. And, you know, so, I mean, again, whether that's true or not, it's saying that it takes all kinds of disciplines to actually help make all this work. So I think the main call to action, because now let's see how long we've been going, because I don't want to... Oh, 46 minutes.
Dang.
I think we got to give them a call to action, son, because we got to lay down the smack, which is the Stanford Medicine Abilities Coalition. Smack!
Which was almost smart.
Oh.
Or the Abilities Alliance.
Oh, so, too many vowels.
Too many vowels.
Sell a vowel. Smack. Buy that C, because smack sounds so much more dope. Smack. Smack. The link is in the thing. I'm going to put more links to, like, Instagram and all the other jazz. You guys should join up. There's power in numbers on this stuff. And I think we should all do our part to kind of understand that this is an important group of people within medicine that are our colleagues, are our doctors, are our nurses, are our physical therapists, and we can do a lot better to understand and decrease stigma. And I've learned a lot from actually knowing Pete and from understanding this, and I'm 70% less of an asshole.
You know, the thing is about like people with disabilities is that they're cool. I think that people with disabilities are super cool. I like people who have been through something and are not like living the picture perfect life.
There's a don't give an F itis about it.
Yes, a don't give an F itis.
Yes.
Exactly.
Which is the prerequisite for cool. You guys understand that?
Yeah.
You're never cool until you no longer care about being cool. You're like, dude, I survived this.
Exactly.
I'm still doing this. F all this. That dude's cool. Or that chick's cool.
Yeah. You will never find like cooler people than at a disabilities event.
Dude.
Because these people have seen everything, done everything, dealt with everything, and they just don't give an F.
You know what?
And it's fucking wonderful.
I did this gig for Janssen Pharmaceuticals a few years ago, and the only reason I agreed to do it was a gig for healthcare bloggers with chronic disease.
Okay.
And Janssen was paying for them all to come out and hear a series of talks from like healthcare people, and I was asked to speak to try to inspire them about using social media. So I'm like, okay, I'll sell out to Big Pharma for this one because it's a good deal. And dude, I'm telling you, these bloggers with like, whether it was ulcerative colitis or, you know, chronic fatigue or whatever their chronic disease was, they were the coolest mother flippers on the planet. And I was like, dude, these guys know how to party. So that's one thing, I think. Once we realize the cool factor, I think that actually goes a long way towards a lot of stuff.
And we're accepting of all sorts of people, even people who are picture perfect. We accept those people, but anybody... like,
you can't point at me. I'm a mess, people. Please. Picture perfect, accepting.
Picture perfect, accepting. We want to welcome all people to our groups. If you care about like human equality and accessibility, and you care about diversity, we want to have you involved with our group. You know, not just about us. When you bring up everyone, you really do bring up everyone, right? I mean, it sounds simple, but it's true.
I'm a huge fan of equality of opportunity. You can't guarantee equality of outcomes, right? Like, I can't say, Pete, you're going to be climbing the Alps with an ice pick. I can't say that, but I can say, Pete, you're going to have every opportunity to excel within what you're capable of doing. I think that's what we ought to be really striving for. We don't have that. We don't even have that.
No.
You know, so if we can fix that.
There's so much, our political climate is so charged right now, too.
You can't even talk about this stuff.
Right?
Yeah.
You can't, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, we're always talking about, people are talking negatively about people who are taking unfairly. And I'm not going to get political about this whole thing, but again, we just need to trust each other to a certain level.
I think assume the best and let people prove you wrong rather than you have to prove to me that you're a good person, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a starting component of all of it. Pete Poulos back for number deuce. The next episode we do with Pete, if you're amenable, is going to be about...
I'm
can
so
I tell him
amenable.
What it's going to be about?
Yes.
ICU psychosis. And this is really an important episode, okay?
It was bad.
It was
bad. It was so bad.
It was bad.
I never thought it would happen to me, but it did.
You guys.
Should I tell them what happened?
I think we have
like
to
a little teaser?
Give them a teaser, and then we'll do the other episode on it, because it's so crazy, you guys, and it could happen to anyone.
Yeah.
So Pete got admitted for sepsis.
Sepsis.
Because, you know, stuff happens.
Stuff has happened.
And lost his mind.
And lost my mind. I was convinced they were putting a dossier of documents together to send to my boss to get me fired for Munchausen's syndrome.
I always knew you had Munchausen's, Pete.
I'm just making it all up.
I knew it.
It's all a farce.
So you guys were making light of it now, but it was such an intense, sucky...
Ask my wife.
It was bad.
Yeah.
Should we ask your wife?
It took me a week to figure out that it wasn't real after I was discharged.
And guess what? This can happen to your loved one. It happens to our patients. Yeah. We see it all the time. And until you experience... And again, now, do you think Pete does not have empathy for people with ICU psychosis in a way that none of us have? Yes, he does. So sometimes going through the ordeal is all it takes.
Any psychosis.
Anything, right?
Even Z-Dog psychosis.
Mm-hmm. It's caused bad by empathy. Just being bald and dope.
It'll be okay.
Pete, hold me. I'm falling.
I will hold you.
My brother. So that stay tuned for the ICU psychosis episode. There's a lot more we're going to talk about with Dr. Pete Poulos. Check out the Stanford Medicine Abilities
Coalition. SMAC.
Or SMAC. We put a link
at
in there.
At Stanford Med AC is our Facebook page, I do believe, and Instagram and YouTube and all of those Twitter,
all those
Twittery things.
And yeah. You get a voice there. You get resources there. It's a thing. And thanks again, brother, for being on the show.
Thank you.
My brother. And we're out.
Peace.
Ooh.